From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The National Rifle Association, once a club for sportsmen, for some time now a political juggernaut, fierce and fiercely focused on gun rights above all else. Well, gun rights and the interests, says my guest today, of gun makers, the arms industry. If you want to know how America became the gun-soaked nation, look in no small part to the record of the NRA. This hour on Point, how the NRA conquered America's gun debate and how it's fighting right now not to lose it. You can join the conversation. How do you see the NRA? Are you a member? Are you happy with where it's taking the country? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. NRA was very quiet after the Newtown massacre, killings of the children there in school. And then in late December began to speak. Here's Executive VP of the NRA, Wayne LaPierre, speaking with David Gregory on Meet the Press. This was in late December. His first interview after the Newtown shootings defended the NRA's stance opposing a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines.
You could ban all Dianne Feinsteins. You could do whatever she wants to do with magazines. It's not going to make any kids safer. We got to get to the real problem, the real causes, and that's what the NRA is trying to do. And I think, I'll tell you this, I have people all over the country calling me saying, Wayne, I went to bed safer last night because I have a firearm. Don't let the media try to make this a gun
issue.
Right,
but that's argument. That's not fact. So let's.
No, it is fact.
People, if you expected the NRA to come out apologetic after those killings, it was an entirely different picture when Wayne LaPierre took the stage, when he sat down with Dick Gregory. There's a whole history here, and it is fascinating when it comes to understanding where we are with guns today. Joining me now from San Francisco is Tim Dickinson, national affairs correspondent and contributing editor at Rolling Stone. His big piece, The NRA Versus America, how the country's biggest gun rights group thwarts regulation and helps put military-grade weapons in the hands of killers, is featured in this week's issue. You can find a link to Tim's article at our website, onpointradio.org. Tim Dickinson, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be here.
I should say right here, we reached out to the National Rifle Association to join us this hour. They did not respond to our invitation. But Tim, you have paid a lot of attention to them right here. There's a lot to look at, but you say a lot of what you're doing here is just marching through the kind of legislative record and the record of the NRA's own makeup and how it's changed. You say there's been a radical transformation within the NRA. It calls itself the oldest civil rights organization in the country, but you quote a longtime lobbyist who left the NRA back in the 90s as saying it has become a cynical, mercenary, political cult. What's the radical transformation you see, Tim?
There's been an alignment with the gun industry. For the first century of its existence, the NRA was strictly a membership group for gun owners, and it was extreme in its own way on ideological grounds, on sort of Second Amendment grounds. But beginning in the late 90s, responding to a threat of legal action, much like the one that humbled Big Tobacco, NRA got out in front of industry and led their charge to immunize the industry against those lawsuits, culminating in a piece of legislation in 2005 that it cleared through Congress that provides sort of blanket immunity for gun makers, gun dealers, gun importers from the end use of their weapons. So it makes it sort of safe for gun makers to have sloppy distribution networks if the guns end up in fly-by-night gun shops that don't perform background checks or sell out the back door. Well, that's somebody else's problem. If the guns get trafficked down to Mexico to help arm the drug insurgency there, well, that's somebody else's problem. And so the industry now has been emboldened to market lethality as sort of their first line of attraction to consumers, and there's no liability there, and so as a result, and as a result of the Citizens United decision, NRA can now take unlimited, undisclosed donations from corporate groups that we know about. We're talking about tens of millions of dollars that have been flowing into the NRA coffers from groups like Ruger, Beretta, Smith & Wesson, ammo sellers like Midway USA, There's representation on the board of the NRA by industry, extensive. There's a nominating committee that selects the board. That, too, is shaped by industry. So there's been a seamlessness with industry, which is new and different and something that we hadn't seen before from the NRA.
Let's walk through that. The NRA, you're right, insists that it is not a trade organization, that it is not affiliated with any firearm or ammunition manufacturers or with any businesses that deal in guns and ammunition. You write in your big piece, Tim, you write quite simply, that is a lie. Let's start with NRA governance, the nominating board, how it's put together, the board of directors. Who's on there?
Well, it's important to understand the NRA, you know, celebrates that it has 4 million plus members. That's a disputable number. There's a long-standing allegations that they don't take dead people off their rolls of lifetime members. So that this undead NRA that appears to bloat those numbers somewhat. But let's grant them millions of members. No one really disputes that. But if you look at polling of the membership, broadly, NRA members themselves are supportive of things like background checks. They're supportive of laws that would have gun owners notify police when their weapon has been stolen. These are sort of common sense things and aren't objectionable to the NRA's membership, but the NRA itself strongly fights them. And so you try and understand why it is that the NRA is so insulated from the actual views of its members. And if you look at it, it's because it's run by a board, a 75, 76 member board that's basically self-perpetuating. The only people who get to vote in the board elections are lifetime members, sort of distinguished lifetime members and annual members with 5 years of consecutive good standing. And the board elections, there's 25 seats at a time, and those are largely determined by a nominating committee. The head of Freedom Group, for example, the parent company of Bushmaster, the assault rifle used in Newtown, is on that committee. So they sort of this slate that's selected by a nominating committee, and then effectively rubber stamped by the membership. There's NRA. Every member gets a magazine, and so this slate of candidates is hyped up in the magazine, and people the voting for the actual board elections is very sort of ironically very small for a group that turns out so many people to the polls on election day. There are very few people who actually care about or care to participate in NRA's governance. So it's about 7% of eligible members, according to insiders, that actually vote in these NRA elections. And so
the result is that the NRA board is stacked with industry brass. Like who?
There's someone from Brownell, which is sort of an internet arms. It's like the Amazon.com of guns and
this
gun
is Pete
parts.
Brownell, president of Brownells. they feature ultra high capacity magazines, all internet arms superstore. He's on the board. Who else?
There's a gentleman named Barrett who runs a Barrett Manufacturing that produces a 50 caliber sniper rifle. This is a monstrous thing that can pierce armor, from an armored limousine, for example, from nearly a mile away. And they also market computer mounted scopes so that you can take a Joe Schmo and give him one of these guns with a computer scope. And it will turn it into something like a special forces sniper in terms of his capacity to hit something far away.
Who else? What about on the ammunition side? Those are gun makers and arms equipment makers. What about ammunition?
Stephen Hornady of Hornady Ammunition, which markets itself under the slogan "Accurate, Deadly, Dependable," and they make armor-piercing bullets. They also make zombie ammunition. There's a big subculture now of folks who go to gun ranges and shoot up zombie dummies, and they're the leading edge of that.
All these on the board, that's before we get to the money. Why have arms manufacturers been so keen in getting on the governing institutions of the NRA?
Well, the arms industry in America is not very big. It's actually, you might think that there's a big gun out there to rival Big Oil or the big three automakers. But it's actually a very modest industry. And so what the NRA does is allow these gun makers to have an impact, a political impact, far beyond what their $1 million donation to NRA would do in any other forum. So as somebody put it to me, that, you know, the gun manufacturers aren't in every congressional district in the country, but gun owners are. And so the NRA is able to whip up single-issue voters in every district in America. And thanks to this confluence of industry, they're able to represent industry but say that they're representing gun owners across the country.
Is the NRA – I mean, you quote the former NRA lobbyist, Richard Feldman, saying it's cynical and mercenary. But does the NRA see it that way, or do they think – look, do they say we're standing up for constitutional rights, we're standing up for our membership, and we just want to be aware of what the industry is thinking?
Well, I don't want to speak for what the NRA, you know, I wish that they were here today. I wish they had responded to you. Mm. I wish they'd responded to my journalistic inquiries. They're not really interested in talking. So I'm not going to ventriloquize them. But, you know, I think the point here is that the interests that are, if you, you know, just look at the polling, if you look at the extreme stances that the NRA takes and who those benefit, who does it benefit to not have background checks? Well, it benefits dealers and gun sellers who are able to profit from illicit sales. You know, whose benefit is it to not crack down on fly-by-night gun shops on the border that are trafficking guns down to Mexico? Well, it's the gun makers, it's the gun dealers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the fierce political power of the NRA, how it has shaped America's gun debate, gun reality, and the NRA's tight big money ties with the gun manufacturing industry, the arms industry. My guest is Tim Dickinson from Rolling Stone, joins us today from San Francisco. Big article in the current issue is the NRA versus America. I should say loud and clear, we invited the NRA to join us in this hour. Wish they had. They did not respond. Tim, it's interesting. Our listeners, you know, they're all over the place on this. 29er says the NRA is only as powerful as the breadth of its membership. If Americans weren't interested in owning guns and evangelizing ownership, there would be no NRA in its current form. On the other hand, Mike says the NRA is a lobbying organization for the gun manufacturing industry. It's a lying fraud hiding behind a corrupt interpretation of the Second Amendment. You know that range of views out there, Tim, about the NRA itself.
Right. And, I would be, if I were, you know, an NRA member, I would be kind of upset about the way that my $35 a year membership gets used. I mean, the NRA is a it's hard to understand it because we think, oh, it's this giant political beast. But it's so much more than that. I mean, the organization has a $250 million, $250 million annual budget. And of that, only about $25 million goes to politics. About $50 million goes to salaries. Wayne LaPierre himself makes $1 million a year.
Well paid.
And then there's, you know, so many ancillary industries, that, you know, sort of arms to the thing. There's a magazine publishing, there's gun ranges, there's gun training. So it's sort of this ravenous beast, but it's very unaccountable to its actual membership. And I think that would concern me if I were, you know, just an average NRA member. And it's interesting, too, that they spend heavily on telemarketing to recruit and maintain a membership. So it's not so much that NRA is a popular upwelling that represents, you know, all gun owners in the country. They have to work and spend and you know, be very aggressive just to maintain their membership numbers that they use very effectively for their own PR.
But very attuned to that money from the arms industry, you write, and this at a moment when the country is really struggling with what to do about gun violence in this country. Lots of explanations for that, but it takes guns to have it in the first place. I mean, even some who've been quite supportive, and I guess not surprisingly, Gabby Giffords, who was big on gun rights, got into politics with that as part of the reason. And her husband, Mark Kelly, they're now urging Congress to act on gun control measures. The president likely to talk about this in his State of the Union speech tonight. Gabby Giffords put out a TV ad Monday, from the Super PAC, Americans for Responsible Solutions. Of course, she was shot in the head in January 2011. Here she is.
We have a problem. Where we shop, where we pray, where our children go to school. But there are solutions we can agree on, even gun owners like us. Take it from me, Congress must act. Let's get this done.
Take it from me, Congress must act. Tim Dickinson says, follow the money. What about that, Tim? You write about, first of all, military-style weapons having become the real profit center of the arms industry. The NRA working very hard against the assault rifle ban. And you talk about money that comes straight out of gun sales to the NRA, the Roundup program, and more. Describe those for us, Tim.
The ammo dealer Midway has a Roundup program, which you make a purchase on their website, and you know the change that would otherwise come back to you on a $29.52 purchase goes to the NRA instead. It rounds up to the nearest dollar, and Midway has donated millions of dollars to the NRA in this capacity. There was a case of a. Someone who went up and shot up a health club had made his purchase through Midway. So NRA actually profited from the gun sale, the ammo sale to a killer.
There's an ammo maker. What about gun maker Ruger? Billion or million guns in a year campaign they had.
Right. So Ruger set out to be the first handgun maker, I believe, to sell a million units in a single year, and they staged their sales around the NRA calendar. So between NRA meetings, the last year of those meetings, they set out to sell a million guns, and for every gun they sold, they would give a dollar to NRA. And so they ended up selling 1.2 million guns or something like that. And the folks who are the sort of corporate titans who lead these companies, they get inaugurated into a secret society, not so secret, but an august society within NRA called the Golden Ring of Freedom, and they're given these bespoke, tailored golden jackets with hand-embroidered gold logos, and they sort of become grandees of the NRA, and they have special access to Wayne LaPierre and to others, and they can help shape policy. And the NRA is quite explicit about this. They have different corporate giving levels. And if you give, $5 million as a person or as a corporation, you get to have a private dinner with Wayne LaPierre at NRA headquarters. And so Wayne LaPierre and NRA function not unlike a political party in the 1990s, where they're sort of auctioning off access and allowing their top corporate donors to help shape policy.
So I'm sure for that, if there's a quid pro quo, they want more than just an evening with Wayne LaPierre. In legislative terms, what does it look to you as though the industry may get in return with the NRA's muscle?
Well, the biggest gift in Congress in the last decade was this 2005 bill that immunized the industry from the series of lawsuits brought by Andrew Cuomo and the Clinton White House and cities around the country that really had the potential to ruin the gun industry. I mean, the gun industry doesn't have the big deep pockets of big tobacco. They didn't sort of have a cushion that they could fall back on, and some gun makers were forging settlements where they were going to stop selling. This was when the assault weapons ban was in effect. They were going to stop selling guns that were backward compatible with high capacity clips. They were going to improve the safety measures of the guns. They were going to do sort of a lot of responsible things with their dealer networks.
And not just anybody. This was Smith & Wesson, which was at the time America's biggest handgun manufacturer. But they were ready to work with the government to do a whole lot of things, as you described. The internal locks, triggers that couldn't be operated by kids, making new guns incompatible with those old high-capacity magazines. The manufacturer was then illegal. They would only ship to dealers who ran background checks on every sale, including at gun shows, and those who refused to sell grandfathered rifles. I mean, Smith & Wesson was the big one on handguns, and they were ready to fall in line with things which would let people do all the hunting in the world that they wanted, but would have changed the profile of guns and gun ownership in this country. How did the NRA take them down off that perch?
They treated Smith & Wesson like a traitor. They actually organized a consumer boycott, sort of turned their membership against this august American gun manufacturer, and nearly ruined it. I mean, it was eventually sold for a song $15 million to a new investment group. But they effectively punished Smith & Wesson, and by so doing, they intimidated the rest of the industry from participating in the kind of deal cutting that Andrew Cuomo, who is now governor of New York but was HUD secretary then and leading the legal effort, was trying to pursue. So they are very powerful both in Congress, but they also were able to shut down this sort of voluntary industry-wide measure. And ultimately, they secured them total immunity, blanket immunity. It's a shocking piece of legislation from Congress itself, so that they're no longer responsible. And then they've moved in the states as well. It's important to understand that NRA doesn't just work in Congress. They work in state houses across the country. They work with a group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is kind of a corporate bill mill. They push legislation through cheap-to-buy state legislators around the country. And so NRA has been on a campaign to relax concealed carry laws to make it possible for people to take their gun off of the nightstand and put it on their body and take it out into public. And then, of course, they've been pursuing these stand your ground laws that became infamous after the Trayvon Martin killing, where if you feel that you need to use that gun in self-defense, you yourself are effectively immunized from the consequences of that, you can't be prosecuted for manslaughter or murder if you have a plausible or even semi-plausible self-defense claim. And so that's where the NRA has put its legislative efforts, in particular because Democrats have abandoned the field in terms of gun legislation following that, more or less following 2004.
They saw George Bush pushed in, and you describe how the NRA support there may have made the difference. That if Al Gore, who had cast an important vote for some gun control, had been able to carry some of those gun-friendly states, he might have been president. The NRA would have been in trouble. They pushed Bush very hard. That's a lot of reality being shaped that you describe right there, Tim. And that's not all of it. You describe this whole business of government data on gun crime being off limits, that they can no longer publish. So it's impossible for, even though it's collected, we can't know about it because of legislation that the NRA pushed on that front.
Right. So 2003, coming up on the expiration of the assault weapons ban, that was a 10-year piece of legislation that was the compromise that was needed to get that through. And so there was a debate about renewing that, and what would be helpful in considering, an assault weapons ban would be an understand, well, what do assault weapons do? Are they involved in more crime? Do they lead to more deadly incidents? And the ATF keeps all that data. They keep very, the Transportation Security Administration knows how many box cutters are collected every year at airports. Well, the ATF does the same thing. They know very, granular level, like how many Bushmasters are used in crime. But thanks to a congressman named Todd Teahart, there were a series of riders, amendments tacked onto appropriations bills that make it illegal or make it impossible to spend for the ATF to spend any money to distribute that information. So if I, as a journalist, make a Freedom of Information Act request, well, ATF can't spend any money to respond to it. And Congress can't even get this information. They were trying to get some during the Fast and Furious investigation. And because Congress is not a law enforcement agency, they aren't even able to get their hands on this data. It's a sort of an appalling crackdown on information, and that's because the NRA doesn't want people to have an informed debate about this stuff, and it's problematic because they used to have this 7-day waiting period on the idea that we end up with misinformed policy based on gut feeling. The 7-day waiting period that people may remember from the Brady Bill before they had instant background checks was on this theory that, oh, there are all these crimes of passion and people go out and buy a gun and use it the next day to off somebody. And in fact, that's actually not in practice what happens. But it made for a good story and ended up in legislation because precisely we don't have good information about guns and gun crime.
Tim, are you making the case here? I mean, that this is it's a principled move to promote and ease gun ownership and the freedom thereof in this country, or that are you saying that these are measures to promote the sale of guns, to sell guns, in effect? I mean, you quote a former NRA lobbyist here talking to the Wall Street Journal, saying the gun industry should send me a basket of fruit. Our efforts have created a new market. This was on right to carry. Is that the case you're making in total?
Well, I mean, the NRA makes that case in that quote that you made. So, I mean, there is a matter of ideology and principle here that isn't so neatly divorced from policies that also help improve gun sales. And so the NRA certainly is aware of the sort of hardcore Second Amendment activist that is out there. And it is also true that there are other gun groups out there that are sort of more hardcore than the NRA. So the NRA is always sort of worried about its right flank and about losing members and in more specifically donors to other groups. And so some of NRA's posturing has to do with appealing to sort of a fringe element within NRA that is very active and can be prodded into giving money. And that we've seen throughout the years. I mean, the NRA in many regards would rather fight than win in many cases, because when they are fighting, it's easier to grow membership. It's easier to, you know, tell people, oh, they're going to take your guns next week.
By your accounting here, they have won a lot. I want to get our listeners in. Diana in Winchester, Massachusetts. Diana, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just really want to thank your guest today for exposing the truth about the NRA and the gun industry. I feel like information getting out like this is the first step towards some regulation, some sanity. And I see the gun industry, I see so many parallels with the cigarette industry, soft drinks, and in terms of just the tactics used for growing a basic consumer base, it's all about big money and profit. And when I hear the NRA saying that people, need to protect themselves, we need more good guys with guns, that just reminds me of a basic marketing tactic that you manufacture need in order to sell your product. And I think of an innocuous example is that whole baby video industry where there were companies selling people baby videos where your baby could learn how to read. And it was ridiculous because your baby doesn't need to learn how to read. But that was actually before people exposed that and sort of took them down, that was big profit.
How do you see the NRA manufacturing need for guns, Diana?
Well, I mean, they're telling you that I think it's the whole sort of gated community mentality that people are susceptible to. You need to be safe and you need to be able to protect yourself because it's a really dangerous, scary world out there. Or in an extreme example in Arizona, you need to be able to take your gun concealed into a bar or into a church. I think it's just preposterous. And I guess my question is, for your guest, is there anything internationally happening on this scale anywhere else in the world, or are we the crazy ones?
Tim?
No, we are the crazy ones. I mean, the data, if you put it in those terms, but the data are just shocking. I mean, the United States has about 11,000 homicide deaths with guns. Japan had 11 in a recent year. So we're off the charts in terms of, I think we're about 19 times the level of gun violence that the rest of the sort of civilized world experiences. So
but we've also got the Constitution with the right to bear arms. It's right there.
Well, and that too, our interpretation of that has been shaped by the NRA, but we could talk about that after the break.
We'll come back and do that. Tim Dickinson is with us from Rolling Stone. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the political power of the NRA, how it has shaped America's gun debate, gun reality, and the NRA's tight big money ties with the gun manufacturing industry, the arms industry. Tim Dickinson is with us from Rolling Stone magazine. Big piece there going through the kind of legislative history and evolution of the NRA over several decades, part and parcel, kind of the spine of what has brought us to our gun policy today. Fingerprints and much more all over our legislation at the federal level, at state level, and beyond. He joins us today from San Francisco. It's interesting. There is the whole range. And again, I should say we invited the NRA to come on in this hour and respond to what Tim's written. They did not respond to our invitation. I wish they were here. Listeners writing in, Pam says, Pamela says, the NRA is the only national firewall between the Second Amendment and those who would infringe upon it. Our constitutional right to own guns is the bedrock of our position, and we rely on the NRA to hold that bedrock. Here's another listener says, I don't have a problem with owning guns. I have an old rifle my grandfather gave me. But I do not, all caps, want to live in an armed society. I do not want people walking around carrying guns. And Gary writes, the NRA bringing the exotic feel of Somalia and Afghanistan to the United States. Great. Let's go to Ronnie in Montgomery, Alabama. Ronnie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
My view is by having the gun and ammunition manufacturers on the board of the NRA, they can use the NRA members' dues and funds as a backdoor source of unlimited lobbying funds without regulation. So basically, these manufacturers are just using members as a source of unlimited, you know, lobbying for them without regulation.
But maybe the membership is happy to see a lot of guns out there. Maybe you've got big, you know, gun owners who have no problem with it, Ronnie.
But a lot of their views are, like I said, a lot of the manufacturers don't want even background checks, where gun owners, us public, say, yes, let's go ahead and do that. Why not have the background checks? But the board's saying no. Well, members are saying yes.
Ronnie, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more from Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Chad is calling. Hi, Chad. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Chad. What do you think?
I just wanted to put, well, I think the NRA is looked at like a monolithic block just run by a bunch of corporate guys and nobody really behind it. That 4 million is a made-up number. But honestly, there's a lot of us out here, myself included, that aren't members of the NRA that really support what they do, but because, in my instance, because of compromises that they've made in the past on our rights, I won't support them. I support smaller groups that are much more uncompromising when it comes to the Second Amendment.
So
they've done well in the last several years, but in the past they have made those compromises, and I don't want to support them in doing so again.
Chad, what's the picture of the country you want? Just help us understand. Do you want more open carry? Do you want more people with guns? Would you feel better about that?
I think that's a personal choice for everyone.
Well, it's also a social choice. I mean, we live together, right? It is a social choice. I mean, we share this country. So
I think the right to carry, that the right to defend oneself is a personal choice, because I'm not living in a situation where, let's say, some women are, where they're victims of domestic abuse. I don't have the same situation going on as a lot of people. I don't live in a bad neighborhood and feel the need to do that. I typically only carry when I'm traveling, okay, because I don't know what type of situation I'm going to be in. But I do own guns, and I'll tell you, the first rifle that I purchased, not that I inherited, that I purchased,
yep,
was post 9/11 when they passed the Patriot Act. And the things that the government has done since then have done nothing to encourage me not to feel that that belief was necessary and correct. And there's a lot of people like me out there that are truly worried where we're going in this country, and we look at it as almost a fire extinguisher that you keep behind glass as a last resort for tyranny.
Chad, I appreciate your call. We'll hear you loud and clear. Thank you for calling in. Tim Dickinson, there's a bunch to look at there, but one piece I want to pick up, and you write about this. Chad says he's very worried about where the country's going. It sounds like he doesn't like government overreach there, sees it in the Patriot Act. Wayne LaPierre at the NRA has, you report, talked a lot along these lines, you know, saying we live in the most dangerous of times. This was at the NRA's 2012 convention in St. Louis. And he's talking about just menacing dangers on all sides. The Obama administration conspiring with the world's dirty-handed thug governments. This is the NRA chief telling lies about the coming realities, saying, you know, we're going to have catastrophic events that will freeze our transportation systems and black out our cities and shut down distribution of fuel and food, unprecedented breakdown of social order. LaPierre telling his assembled crowd there, Americans are facing the reality that they're on their own. What the heck, Tim? What is that about?
The NRA sells the fear that sells the gun. It's kind of just that simple. The marketing associations, you know, if that were to come out in an ad for Ruger, it would seem unseemly and gross. Although there is some advertising out there that is not too dissimilar. But the idea here is that the NRA is free to talk about this dangerous world that we live in, and the only solution is to have a personal firearm with you at all times, and preferably one that has a high-capacity magazine in case you have to shoot a bunch of people because, you know, society's broken down and there's whatever fearsome danger at your door. It's a cynical sales pitch for weaponry.
I mean, their positions have become much harder. It's very striking. You open right up talking about, again, Wayne LaPierre after Columbine. This was 1999, the NRA convention. It was in Denver, Colorado, just not so far from Columbine, just a couple of weeks after a very deadly school shooting there. And here was Wayne LaPierre then in 1999 saying the NRA believed that guns should not be allowed in schools at all.
We believe in absolutely gun-free, zero-tolerance, totally safe schools. That means no guns in America's schools, period.
That was the NRA, Wayne LaPierre, 1999. Here he was, just after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, took the lives of 27, including 20 children, but this time very confrontational and saying, you've got to have guns in these schools.
The only way to stop a monster from killing our kids is to be personally involved and invested in a plan of absolute protection. The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Get guns into those schools. Wayne LaPierre facing reality, Tim, or making reality?
Well, if you understand NRA as a group that represents the interests of the gun lobby, gun manufacturers, well, what does that proposal do? It expands a new market for gun ownership. It's 100,000 public schools in this country. All of a sudden, that's a rich new market to tap. And it also has these folks would, under the NRA's proposal, be trained by the NRA. And so there's an aspect to that that's self-serving, too. It expands the power and the influence of the NRA. And more generally, it creates a society where guns are socially acceptable. Kids will grow up seeing guns on people that they respect and walking the halls of their school. And so this doesn't come out of nowhere. This is very well thought through on the part of the NRA. But I think the interesting point is that moment in 1999 after Columbine mm-hmm. was sort of right before the NRA made this big play to get in front of industry. And so you can see the contrast in the statements, and you can also sort of see that there is no ideological mooring there, that this is something that is rooted in the politics of the moment for the NRA in both instances. And so that one's adherence to the Second Amendment has nothing to do with the actual political proposals that were being put forward then or being put forward now.
Well, here's another contrast. I mean, the other thing on the table now is background checks, universal background checks. And again, maybe it's the pivot toward the industry that you described. But after Columbine, again, 1999, Wayne LaPierre testified in front of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Crime, talked about background checks every sale, every gun show, no loopholes, as the best way to prevent future gun violence in America. Here he is in 1999.
So let's talk about what's reasonable and what's not. We think it's reasonable to provide mandatory instant criminal background checks for every sale at every gun show. No loopholes anywhere for anyone.
Every sale, every gun show, no loopholes. That was before what Tim Dickinson describes as deeper ties with the gun industry, the arms industry. Here was Wayne LaPierre again at the Senate Judiciary Committee earlier this month saying universal background checks are not the answer to preventing gun violence.
My problem with background checks is you're never going to get criminals to go through universal background checks. I mean, they're all the law-abiding people. You'll create an enormous federal bureaucracy, unfunded, hitting all the little people in the country. We'll have to go through it, pay the fees, pay the taxes.
We don't even prosecute anybody right now that goes through the system we have. So we're going to make all those law-abiding people go through the system, and then we aren't going to prosecute any of the bad guys if they do catch one. And it none of it makes any sense in the real world.
Tim Dickinson, how do you see the NRA position right now? I mean, the president's going around. He was in Minneapolis. He's going to Chicago this week. State of the Union tonight, no doubt. He will talk about guns. He's saying we've got to rally behind this, those who support his view of what our sort of gun policy should be. I think people looked at Newtown and said, whoa, that's huge. That's unacceptable. Maybe things will change. How do you see the NRA's clout these days, Tim?
I think they're an enormously powerful group. I mean, the underappreciated aspect of what's also happened in very recent years is that the Citizens United decision, which allowed unlimited and undisclosed money into politics, has put the NRA in a very interesting position. They are incorporated by an accident of their history as a 501c4. And that's the same designation that Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS group has. And so this is it's like a super PAC, except that they don't have to disclose their donors. And
so it's so-called dark money here.
Dark money. A dark money super PAC is what they are now. And the anxiety that a group like Karl Rove's has is that these 501c4 groups are supposed to spend a predominant, you know, 51% of their budget effectively on social welfare activities. Mm-hmm. Well, Karl Rove's group just does advertising, political advertising.
So it's hard for him, but not for them because they've got what?
They've got all these ancillary activities. They've got, you know, magazines. They've got shooting clubs. So the NRA is sort of perfectly positioned as a dark money super PAC, sort of by an accident of its history, just at a moment that they are reaching out to the gun manufacturers for giant donations.
Is the dark money coming in? Can you tell?
Well, that we know about. They don't have to disclose their donations, and they're well behind in their IRS disclosure. So we only have IRS disclosures through 2010, which was effectively the first year of the Citizens United world. But they've opened up a donor level for the Charlton Heston level of giving for donors who give $25 million and above. So this is clearly an ocean that they're fishing in. Whether they're reeling in these big fish, these guys with Koch brother-sized wallets, it's not entirely clear at this moment. And it may not ever be clear. I mean, you can kind of look through the glass darkly at the IRS filings, but they're not very explicit. Although, interestingly, we did see that Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS group made a $600,000 grant directly to NRA, sort of in this confluence of dark money groups.
Let's go to Alan in New Orleans. Alan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, my concern is, as a pro-gun person, as an NRA member, one of the things that I keep hearing people talk about, oh, we respect the Second Amendment and people's rights to hunt, but self-defense is also a primary right of the Second Amendment, in my opinion, and the opinions of a lot of other people.
Supreme Court.
And one of the concerns that I have about the whole background check, 100%, zero loopholes, all those things, is that gets us closer and closer to gun registration, which gets us closer and closer to the possibility of gun confiscation. And it's a slippery slope. Do I want to be able to tighten things down to keep, you know, criminals and people who have mental health issues from being able to get to guns? Yes. If there's a way of being able to do that, I want to. But where do you draw the line between keeping the guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them and preventing the rights of people who do?
Alan, I hear what you're saying. Let me ask you about the other slippery slope, though. How do we keep from becoming, you know, just sort of a gun-toting nation where everywhere you turn, there are guns? It has not always been that way. And how do we keep from going there?
Well, quite honestly, I'm not afraid of guns. The thing is that there's a lot of people in this country that oftentimes, because of regional cultural issues, whether you're more of an urban individual or a rural individual, the urban people, a lot of people don't grow up around guns, don't understand them. A lot of the rural people grow up around them and do.
Well, I grew up around them. I grew up around them in the country. But I didn't grow up around them, you know, at the grocery store, not at a basketball game, not walking down Main Street, except on a policeman's hip.
Bottom line, that doesn't worry me. What worries me is the fact that if I'm out somewhere, I don't know how close I am to the nearest police department or who's going to be there to back me up. I've worked in the law enforcement industry. 911 is really good in terms of being able to respond to the crime after the fact and chase people down after the fact, but very, very infrequently does it happen that the police department stops the bad guy from committing the crime in the first place.
Alan, we're out of time practically here, but I appreciate your call from New Orleans. Tim, with the NRA's power, with its clout, where do you see us going? You've got Mayor Bloomberg in New York saying, hey, they're not so powerful, but you've got many others saying, oh, yes, they are. You know, if you're right, if they're joined at the hip with the arms industry, does that mean that they will just push for more and more and more? Are we going to become that guns everywhere country even more than we are now?
It's hard to say exactly, but I think in looking at this political fight that's brewing, all this legislation is going to have to go through the House, which is dominated by Republicans. And the important thing to understand about the NRA's political clout is their biggest weapon is being able to primary someone. So if someone gets out of line with the NRA position, that person is going to face a primary fight. And there's no cavalry that comes to the aid of people who stand up to the NRA. And so you have a wide variety of Republican politicians in particular who are cowed by the NRA and very fearful for their jobs if they cross the NRA. And that applies to many Democrats too, I should say.
Well, it sounds like it was going to take a counterweight of some kind. President Obama talking about rallying that. But we shall see. It's a tall order. Tim Dickinson, we're out of time. We appreciate your being with us. The Rolling Stone in this week's edition. The piece is The NRA versus America, How the Country's Biggest Gun Rights Group Thwarts Regulation and Helps Put Military-Grade Weapons in the Hands of Killers. Tim, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.